As many jobs lost in the past month as all those created since the Great Recession, now Texas hospitals struggling to make ends meet. The story today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. Other stories we're tracking: the oil and gas industry asking for more state regulation, more on an historic hearing aimed at trying to stop an historic downward spiral. One place where business is good, check in with some factories on the Texas-Mexico border. Also, the Texas governor set to talk about plans aimed at getting back to business. A top pandemic expert at Texas A&M has a warning. Those stories and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets started right after this. No matter where you are, there's no way to sugarcoat it. The news is not good. I'm David Brown. It's the Texas Standard time on this April 16th, 2020. Thanks for joining us. New numbers from the Labor Department show 22 million Americans have lost their jobs over the past 4 weeks. More than 1 million Texans filed for unemployment last month. These devastating numbers are certain to add fuel to a debate over how long to keep imposing restrictions on business activity. According to former Treasury Department official Michael Monderer, now a research analyst for Texas-based Stratfor, if stay-at-home orders remain in place and businesses remain shuttered into the next quarter, the U.S. is likely to see unemployment reach levels of 20% to 30% by year's end, levels equaling or surpassing the Great Depression, when joblessness peaked at 24.9% and mass migration, soup kitchens, and bread lines became common sights across this country. Yesterday, many Americans were stunned by the news that Best Buy, one of the best-known consumer electronics retailers, would be furloughing 51,000 staffers. The Wall Street Journal is now warning we are entering a new second round of layoffs, including people who thought their jobs were secure, such as many white-collar professionals. But in Texas, one warning signal that things are especially bad, perhaps to the point of dangerous, is a rapidly tightening Gordian knot in the healthcare industry. The Texas Tribune reports now that health facilities on the front lines in the pandemic fight are under severe financial pressure, having lost massive amounts of money on surgeries and other procedures now deemed non-essential. In other words, at the exact time when healthcare facilities are most needed to battle a pandemic, the economic shutdown may require them to lay off workers and shutter their doors. Joining us now is Shannon Najmabadi. She is a reporter for the Texas Tribune. Shannon, thanks for joining us today on the Texas Standard. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
What sort of news are you hearing? Apparently, this seems to be coming out of East Texas predominantly. What are you hearing?
It's happening across the country, really. This is a story about a possibly unexpected side effect of what's been a pretty steep drop off, like you said, in surgeries and other procedures that make up a significant portion of healthcare facilities' revenue. This is due to a couple of things that have happened. One is the gubernatorial order postponing all procedures that are not immediately medically necessary. Mm-hmm. But it's also because people are heeding health warnings and just staying out of hospitals and doctors' offices as much as possible, and being home more in compliance with local orders, which basically means they're getting in car accidents and things like that less.
Forgive me for interrupting. You start out your story for the Texas Tribune in Titus County in Northeast mm-hmm. Texas. Tell us a little bit about what they're seeing there.
Yes, Titus County has Titus Regional Medical Clinic. They are a healthcare facility that services five counties. They're one of the rural hospitals that has financial pressures even without a pandemic. And they're one of many healthcare facilities that have actually had to furlough or lay off workers because of this tight financial strain that they're facing. So there, just to give you an example, under normal circumstances, they have 800 employees, average of 65 patients in the emergency room, senior volunteers working the doorways. Now, the traffic has dropped significantly down to a low of 25 patients from 65 in April. Mm-hmm. Looking ahead and thinking, we might have another month or so without any of these elective procedures that bring in revenue. The CEO of that hospital and his team actually sat down and made a pretty tough decision to lay off or furlough 10% of their staff. So that's 80 employees that are affected. And these are employees that primarily don't work with patients. They're clinical, administrative. They work in ambulatory services. But the CEO there said, at a rural hospital, these are very tough calls. for me to make. You know, I'm laying off and terminating and furloughing friends and colleagues that I've known for a long time.
You know, we've been hearing a little bit about the troubles that have been facing rural hospitals and healthcare facilities, but you're also reporting that some facilities in big cities, like Dallas-based Tenet Healthcare Corporation, they are concerned as well.
Yes, it's true. It's not unique to rural hospitals, even though they are vulnerable to financial blows. Doctors' offices have seen, you know, significant cuts to their revenue. Large hospital systems also have not been immune. Just to give you a couple of examples, the you know, Dallas-based Tenet Healthcare Corp that you mentioned, Methodist Healthcare in San Antonio. Some of these bigger systems are trying to redeploy employees who now are having reduced hours because they're having so many less patients come in. And if they can't redeploy those employees, they're offering them, you know, a percentage of their base pay, so maybe 70%. So healthcare providers are also seeing their pay reduced at this time.
Is it possible that the surge of patients looking for treatment for, you know, from coronavirus would offset some of that economic impact from the loss of surgeries and that sort of thing?
I think that treating coronavirus patients is not as lucrative as doing some of these surgeries. But I think that one of the big problems right now is that healthcare facilities are gearing up for this potential surge, but they're also seeing traffic slower than it's been maybe ever before because they, in many places like Titus, are not seeing a surge.
What about federal aid? I believe there was, what, $100 billion in an aid package for healthcare providers?
Yes, that's right. So $30 billion of this $100 billion in federal aid has begun being disbursed. It's based on past Medicare billings, which doesn't advantage every facility, depending on what their primary sources of revenue are. So this is an infusion that obviously helps, but some experts like Moody's Investors Service forecast it won't be enough, especially if the elective surgeries continue to be postponed through late spring, potentially into the summer.
Shannon Najmabadi continues to follow this developing story as reporter for the Texas Tribune. Shannon, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Some oil and gas companies are asking the state to regulate them more. I'll say that again. Some oil and gas companies are asking the state to regulate them more. What once sounded improbable is for real. They're asking the Texas Railroad Commission to put a cap on production for all companies in the state, saying it'll help stabilize plummeting energy prices. Not everyone agrees, and the commission heard both sides in a virtual and rather historic hearing. Houston Public Media's Kyra Buckley listened in.
First of all, online meetings can be awkward. Am I on mute? Can you see me? Is that a dog? And all these things are still true when the leaders of oil and gas companies, along with experts and economists, logged on for the commission's first ever virtual public hearing.
You'll need to unmute yourself.
But once people figured out how to unmute, it turns out they had widely varied things to say about the state mandating production cuts. From concern about intervention in the market to a plea from some small producers to, quote, spread the pain around, testimony got a bit heated at times. Exploration and production companies Pioneer Natural Resources and Parsley Energy requested the hearing. They want the commission to cut Texas oil production by 1 million barrels a day for the month of May. This would be done through proration. Regulators would mandate all companies make cuts to reduce waste. First up to testify was Pioneer CEO Scott Sheffield. He says the commission is compelled to act when supply of oil outpaces market demand. Sheffield says storage here in Texas is, quote, filling to the brim and waste is inevitable if nothing is done.
Is waste occurring? Yes. No one disputes that production in Texas and globally vastly exceeds demand. Certainly none of those who submitted comments to the commission disagree. Witnesses here today have strongly different views about whether proration is a remedy, and that's the issue, but no one disputed the facts that waste is occurring.
While opponents of the cuts agree that there is an oversupply, they say the state should stay out of the free market. Sheffield took issue with that.
You have to be joking. After 35 years as a CEO, I've never seen a free market. Many of the companies speaking after me are asking for government debt bailouts, tariffs, carbon tax credits. Is that free market?
But some didn't buy that argument. Jim Teague is CEO of Houston-based Enterprise Products. He's against the measure, and he called out Parsley and Pioneer during his testimony.
Asking for you to take this action makes me wonder about the true agenda. Are they really trying to fix a problem, or do they want to argue that government action by you gives them the opportunity to get out of some of their obligations?
Teague argued that the market can indeed correct the current imbalance. He says that producers might have to accept prices they don't like, but it won't get to the point where storage is overflowing.
I've never seen storage fill up. I don't accept that thesis because invariably markets work and somebody will stick their head up and offer a price. Then the seller has to decide whether they want the price.
But some small companies said things are moving so fast, price may not matter.
One purchaser canceled our contracts effective May 1st with no renegotiation for 2,000 barrels per day.
That's Jim Wilkes. He's the president and co-owner of Texland Petroleum. His Fort Worth company employs just over 70 people. Wilkes is worried that if the state doesn't move forward with production cuts for everyone, his company will continue to see canceled contracts. That means he might have to shut in wells for good instead of just limiting how much they produce.
If you look at what proration would do, it's going to restrict production from everybody equally, presumably. And so that means that some of these markets that we've been cut off from would be opened up to us potentially.
The details of how proration would actually work are still up in the air. The earliest a vote could come on the measure is when the three commissioners meet again on Tuesday. I'm Kyra Buckley in Houston.
And Wells Dunbar is in the Texas capital city. What are you hearing from our listeners today, Wells?
Hi, David. Well, that staggering set of unemployment numbers released today, another 5.2 million Americans filing for unemployment last week, has folks talking as the nationwide total, as you mentioned, over the past month reaches a heretofore unimaginable 22 million people. On the Texas Standard Facebook page, Marcia Alonzo, alluding to widely reported issues with overloaded unemployment systems, writes, "And those are just the ones that were able to apply." Martha Dunkelberger says, "If the economy had been as strong as the Trump administration claimed it was, we wouldn't have had to be concerned about children going hungry if we closed the schools or families losing their homes if one of them couldn't work. That booming economy was all a mirage. The rich got richer and the poor got poorer and more invisible," she writes. Meanwhile, Luke Speckman is more optimistic. "Open the economy and it will roar back," he writes. Just a sampling of what we have, what we're seeing out there, rather, David. I'll be back with more later in the show.
Let us know what you are seeing, Texas. You reach out to us at Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice. Wells Dunbar is our social media editor, and he continues to monitor your comments. He'll be joining us again in about 35 minutes here on The Standard. Stay with us.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
Business and Your Money on The Standard. I'm David Brown. The Texas-Mexico border is a hub for manufacturing. Most factories there are shut down, but those that are open are quite busy trying to meet demand for goods in short supply. KTEP's Angela Cocherga reports.
When COVID-19 forced many businesses to close, some manufacturers on the border saw a critical need to get to work. Emma Schwartz is president of the Medical Center of the Americas Foundation. The nonprofit organization based in El Paso supports biomedical companies in this border region.
We had no idea that the efforts we'd be engaging in would be so critical to the crisis that we're experiencing right now.
Those efforts include fostering collaboration and innovation among the cluster of medical manufacturers and suppliers in the Ciudad Juarez, El Paso area. That mission is critical during the COVID-19 crisis.
We found innovators all over the region and really around the country and Mexico coming together, seeing how they could support each other to produce new innovations that could support the crisis.
The goal: ramp up production of personal protective equipment and ventilators desperately needed by hospitals on both sides of the border. Cecilia Levine is a founder of the nonprofit U.S.-Mexico-Canada Strategic Alliance.
We're also working with a group in Ciudad Juarez, in Monterrey, and Sonora, and Tijuana. We are all formed a group with the advice of some researchers from MIT and some researchers from India to try to create a ventilator that can be also very affordable and easy to put together.
They're working to quickly get that ventilator tested and approved for hospitals in the next few weeks. But it's not just medical companies helping during the COVID-19 pandemic.
The good thing is that in Ciudad Juarez and many parts of Mexico now, we have a lot of incredible engineers and designers that are now with this coronavirus are being showcased as coming up with excellent ideas.
Ciudad Juarez is home to more than 350 manufacturing plants. Most are shut down to prevent the spread of COVID-19. Those doing essential work are operating, and some are repurposing material and supplies, says Schwartz.
People are looking at converting automotive operations into medical device. For example, there are a lot of covers that are made for the seats inside of automobiles. Those operations could be converted to making isolation gowns.
Levine's company usually makes bedding and home furnishings at factories in El Paso and Ciudad Juarez. Now, the company's mass-producing washable face masks for essential workers, protective hospital bed mattress covers, and another product in demand in COVID-19 hotspots.
Unfortunately, we're also making body bags.
A grim reminder of the pandemic's rising death toll, as border manufacturers race to make life-saving equipment and protective gear. In El Paso, I'm Angela Kocherga.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a health and safety-focused workers' compensation provider, reminding Texans that the best way to stick together right now is to stay apart. More at texasmutual.com/coronavirus.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Apple and Google, working together? In times like these, perhaps nothing should surprise us. Sure enough, the two tech giants who compete so fiercely for our mobile phone dollars have announced a joint project to support COVID-19 contact tracing, a way for public health authorities to use our phones to find out who an infected person may have come into contact with and hopefully slow the spread of the virus. Who better to help us understand what this oil and water collaboration is all about than our go-to tech expert, Omar Gayaga. Hello there, Omar.
Hey, David. Thanks for having me.
I should provide a warning to our listeners. If you say Google, your phone might just start scrolling and recording everything you're saying, like mine just did, by the way.
Always listening.
Yes, I know. All right, let's get back to this announcement. What are Apple and planning?
Well, Apple and Google have announced that they are working together to try to use their technologies together to kind of collaborate to make contact tracing easier. And that is, you know, tracking who people who may have been infected with COVID-19 have been in contact with. And what it uses is the phone's Bluetooth capabilities to see, you know, where other devices have been within 6 feet. There's some issues on the technology side, and then there's also some issues on whether people will actually use this technology, and we can get into that. But that's really the big news is that Apple and Google have announced that in May they will be releasing an API for this, which will allow developers to kind of create apps on top of that.
So what you're talking about here is contact tracing, right? This is the idea that if you come within proximity of someone and that someone has been diagnosed. But that's the key, right? You have to have had more testing done for this to be actually practical, it seems to me.
Yeah, and I mean, it would, you know, not take the place of traditional contact tracing where, you know, you're asking the person, you know, where have you been? Who have you been in contact with? You know, who might have been exposed? That would still continue to happen. But this would be a way to also do it through the phone, which may actually be more accurate if, you know, people's memories are not always fantastic. So this would actually could provide a better picture, but there are some technical limitations in that Bluetooth, you know, if you've ever dealt with Bluetooth, can be a little bit flaky sometimes. It goes further than 6 feet. So those are some issues. And then really the big one is, are people really going to voluntarily download an app that will contact trace them. This is not going to be something that's going to be mandated or required. It's going to be something that people will have to opt in and want to download and help that effort.
Yeah, privacy is a major issue, it seems to me. I mean, first of all, there's this issue of, in the best of times, it's hard to imagine Apple and Google collaborating and in such short order, too. Now they've come together to gather this data. Well, is it reasonable not to be a little bit suspicious of two massive data conglomerates coming together for an app that could bring together a whole lot of very powerful information?
Yeah, that is the concern. And I mean, this is data that your phone is already kind of collecting. You know, we've talked about location tracking, that these, you know, phones and apps are already sort of figuring out, you know, where you are at any given moment. This would at least be for, you know, a useful purpose in helping public health. And it would also be retroactive. So, you know, if you were to do this contact tracing, it would go back the 14 days. It wouldn't be from then on. It would actually be able to go back to the day. So that data is already being collected. The question then becomes like, well, okay, well, who gets that data? Where does it go? And Apple and Google have both promised that the person who would be submitting that data would be anonymous, but it would help health officials to be able to contact people who may have been exposed and kind of warn them.
I'm not so clear on how anonymous that actually sounds. But what about safeguards? I mean, is this something that you could opt in or out of? Do you have a switch that you could turn on or off? Of course, there are a lot of switches on Facebook too. So I don't know. I mean, how do you feel about that?
That's the thing, is that it would be in the form of an app that people would have to download and sign on for. You know, is that something that enough people are going to want to do to make it effective? I mean, I'm seeing some estimates of it would have to be 60 or 70% of people would have to download this for it to actually make a huge impact. And then there's another idea of Apple and Google kind of baking this into those operating systems. Instead of an app that you download, it would actually be an option within the OS that you could enable without having to download something separate in future versions of iOS and Android.
So is there a timeline on this stuff?
Yes, Apple and Google plan to release the API in May, and you know, given the speed of app development, we should see some stuff roll out really quickly after that.
Omar Gayaga keeps a safe distance over at techminutetexas.com, where you can check out his work. Omar, keep us posted on this, and thanks so much for stopping by.
Thanks, David. Stay safe. Appreciate it.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, where Horned Frogs strive to be responsible world citizens. More on how a trip to Norway challenged students' perspectives on mass incarceration and justice at tcu.edu/stories.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. A Texas judge is planning to open up mail-in voting during the COVID-19 pandemic to anyone concerned about contracting the virus. The Texas Democratic Party and several civil rights groups filed a lawsuit to increase voting by mail access for elections in July and November. James Barragan is covering the case for the Dallas Morning News. He says Republican Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton is expected to appeal the ruling.
So for the longest time, Republicans in Texas and perhaps nationwide, including the president, have said that mail-in ballots are problematic and are a system that's ripe for abuse.
In a statement Wednesday, Paxton said expanding mail-in voting will lead to fraud. Texas has one of the strictest mail-in voting programs in the country. The Congressional Hispanic Caucus is urging party leaders in the U.S. Senate and House to include protections and financial assistance for farm workers in the next COVID-19 relief bill. Provisions lawmakers are pushing for include funding for community health centers in rural areas and protecting undocumented agricultural workers from deportation. San Antonio Democrat Joaquin Castro chairs the caucus.
We're concerned that because the immigration issue is often a third rail issue and politicians tend to sometimes steer away from it because they don't want to, you know, mess with a hornet's nest, what happens is that people will often ignore these workers. And there's a danger to that, especially right now.
Castro says failing to protect farm workers could disrupt the nation's food supply. More communities in Southeast Texas are expanding COVID-19 testing to everyone, whether or not they have symptoms. Houston Public Media's Sasha Cordner has more.
Starting today, Galveston County Health Department will now be offering free testing to anyone. Residents just need to make an appointment and bring some form of ID. Fort Bend County also opened COVID-19 testing to all residents at its testing site. They just need to call and schedule a date and time to come in and come to the appointment with a specific identification code. Earlier this week, Houston opened up its coronavirus testing to everyone as well to give them a sense of how much community spread there has been in the area.
Sasha Cordner reporting. The statewide gas price average continues falling and is now down to $1.57 per gallon. AAA Texas spokesperson Josh Zuber explains daily gas consumption in the U.S. has plunged since the COVID-19 pandemic shut down normal economic activity.
Levels we haven't seen really since the 1960s, 5.1 million barrels per day, which is nearly half of the demand from a year ago, according to the latest U.S. Energy Information Administration. Data.
I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard time. I'm David Brown. Millions of Texans began to see federal stimulus money appear in their bank accounts over the weekend. For still others, the check's in the mail and it can't come soon enough. Rent and mortgage payments were due days ago. Food is due every day. Kids' essentials can't wait. At a moment like now, what do you do? Joyce Kavanaugh, Ph.D., is a specialist in family economics and disaster assessment and recovery at Texas A&M AgriLife Extension Service. She joins us now with some tips. Thanks so much for joining us on the Texas Standard. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Let's begin by how you start to take stock. I suppose if you don't have the money to make all the payments, what comes first? Most people think rent. You got the credit cards due as well. What comes first?
Well, I think you have to look at what are some things that you might be able to postpone without any dire consequences, and what are the things that absolutely have to be paid. And usually we tell people to think about what are those things that affect the health and safety of your family, food, shelter, maybe utilities if your community doesn't have a program where they're giving people some leeway in making payments. There are several programs right now that would help people delay mortgage payments. If you have a federally backed mortgage from FHA, Fannie Mae, right. Freddie Mac, you can request a forbearance of up to 180 days in which to delay payments. Student loans, any federally held student loan now is not even being collected until September. So those are two areas that are really big chunks of funding in people's budgets that they should look for what options are there. And one of the best ways of doing that is to contact your creditors right up front.
I want to jump in here because a lot of people live on their credit cards. I mean, this is the only right. way that they sort of make it from paycheck to paycheck. So do you red flag the credit card companies already that you're having some trouble here? I mean, could that, is that the way to go?
Yes. Try to make at least the minimum payment. But if you can't even do that, contact the credit card company and see what options they have available right now. Creditors are expecting to hear from a lot of their customers, and they're offering programs and options that can help their customers delay payments. So yes, definitely contact the creditors.
Okay. Now, what about benefits? I'm thinking about the fact that a lot of folks in Texas are for the first time having to reach out to the government for assistance. Mm-hmm. Many people don't even know where to begin.
Well, obviously, if you've lost a job, you've either been laid off or let go, unemployment, and I know there's a big backlog right now, but be persistent, be patient. Also, a drop in income may now make you eligible for SNAP benefits, which what you know we think of as food stamps.
Right.
And maybe your kids would be eligible now for CHIP or Medicaid. So go to the yourtexasbenefits.com website, and you can apply for SNAP, Medicaid, CHIP on that website.
Yourtexasbenefits.com, is that right?
Correct.
I know that some people have said that they have received phone calls from the IRS. 'Tis the season for frauds and scams, I guess. It's just hard to know what's fake and what's real right now.
Right. be careful. The IRS will never reach out to you by telephone. They will always communicate with you via the U.S. mail. They won't email you. They're not going to call you. So as these economic relief payments are starting to arrive, be on the lookout for people who are trying to get that money from you. Also, there is no such thing as an approved COVID home testing kit. That's another scam that's going around right now. So if you get phone calls, you get emails, just hang up. You're not obligated to be nice to people who call trying to rip you off. Just hang up the phone or delete that email.
What about services offered by people to help you navigate this labyrinth of benefits or creditors? What do you tell them? I mean, I know that there are experts in that who can help these people, but how do you know the good ones from the bad ones?
I would recommend people look at their person's credentials. Are they a CFP, Certified Financial Planner? Are they an accredited financial counselor? The designation AFC. Are they a certified credit counselor? You know, what is the credential? Don't agree to do anything with anybody that you have not approached. You know, look up whether someone has been, their license has been suspended, if they actually have that license that they say they do. Do your due diligence in making sure that the people that you're working with actually are trained in what they're telling you they can help you with.
Reach out for help, but protect yourself. Sound advice from Joyce Cavanaugh, Texas A&M AgriLife Extension Service, College Station. Thanks so much for spending a few minutes with us on the Texas Standard.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you. Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with small and mid-sized companies by helping to unify their businesses and achieve digital transformation. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
You're tuned to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. U.S. House Speaker Tip O'Neill of Massachusetts once famously said, "All politics is local." It was a statement both bold and obvious, and eventually his axiom would become part of the American lexicon. You know, if Texas were to develop its own iconic axiom, it might want to put its mind where its mouth is. In his new book, Jose Ralat travels across Texas and the U.S. to discover how a food once thought of as inherently Mexican now tells us a whole lot about who we are as Americans. This book is American Tacos, and the author, Jose Ralat, is the first taco editor for Texas Monthly. Jose, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Your book is sort of an old-school road trip with a lot of history and a lot of great storytelling here. So how did you decide to sort of segment the chapters as you did?
So I wanted to talk about as many different American developed tacos as I could in as simple a format as possible. So I chose 8 tacos that are really more than 8 tacos once you get into those chapters, and focus on them as the foundations, because there are a lot more than 8.
yeah, I'll say. You know, I want to jump into one of them if you're cool with it. Mm-hmm. You write about the Helen of Troy of tacos, and this raises perhaps the most contentious question ever asked by Texans: where in the state can you get the best breakfast tacos, and what makes it the Helen of Troy of tacos?
Well, everyone wants to claim the beauty that is the breakfast taco, and everyone sees it as their right these days. and the fact of the matter is that Austin, San Antonio, Corpus, no one owns that. As I say in the book, the breakfast taco is a border food. It doesn't necessarily belong to Texas, but it's certainly a Texas food.
Is there a city that can claim to have invented? Because I know that there have been various accounts which have exploded into various breakfast taco wars over the years, which you write right. about. But is there a place that can rightfully claim the origin of the breakfast taco?
Yes, Mexico.
There we go. So take that, Austin, San Antonio, Dallas.
Although you won't find very many good breakfast taco places here in Dallas. That's one thing that we are short on.
Why do people feel so attached to their tacos? There's something cultural happening there.
Right. So tacos are defined by their time and place, that they are a reflection of who we are via population shifts, market supply and demand. They're the manifestation of who and what we are and all of our desires in this little dish. Why do people feel so strongly about them is because everyone's worked so hard to develop or add a piece of themselves and their culture to something that is quickly globalizing.
You write about the complicated history of barbacoa, which is obviously big in Texas, but
yes,
I think in some circles, and you talk about this, kind of look down upon. You describe barbacoa as having barbaric connotations, but doesn't barbacoa just mean barbecue?
Barbecue means about
yeah, let's get that right.
It's the other way around. So that was one of the interesting notes that I found during my research, is that because it is or was traditionally cooked in the ground, it is looked down upon, it is barbaric. There are some reports by colonizing Europeans that some barbacoa was actually human flesh. I don't know if that's true. I mean, you know, when the Spanish first came over, they said a lot of things, and some of them aren't true. They weren't true. They were justifications for their own barbarism.
That's really interesting. And you think that sense of what barbacoa was sort of survived the years into, mm-hmm. well, nowadays, I mean, people love barbacoa, but even today, I mean, it's like it's often considered as the meat that's left over, right?
Right, right. And that's certainly where it got its modern roots. It's the cowhead predominantly, which no one really wants. So the white ranchers would give it to the Mexican ranch hands, and they would make a feast out of it.
But it is arguably the best, most flavorful taco you can get in Texas. In fact, you write about this place in Brownsville, right? Sort of ground zero.
Yes. Vera's. Vera's is the only restaurant in the state that is permitted to cook barbacoa de res in the ground. And they do so in a brick-lined pit, cooking it for 12, 14 hours. What comes out is silky, fatty, just a tad bit smoky. It's delightful.
I want to get down there now and check it out.
But it's so far away, even from Austin.
Well, still, it's worth it, I think.
Hey, yes, it is.
Quick final question.
Sure.
For listeners who might just have a couple of miles to, you know, find their favorite taco place, are there any tip-offs, some signs of a truly amazing taco joint?
Sure. There's the packed parking lot. Although I'm not sure that you want to do that right now, considering the pandemic. Right. There are things that you can look for on the outside of a restaurant. For example, are they advertising handmade tortillas? I recommend that you order whatever they make in-house. What else? You know, look at their salsas. Do they have more than red and green? These are things that will lead you to a whole new level of a taco experience.
And the expert has given you some sound advice there. Indeed, Jose Relat has written the book on American tacos, literally. Jose, congratulations, and thanks so much for spending some time with us on the Texas Standard.
Thank you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, dedicated to the fight against cancer through telemedicine. Now more than ever, providing patients with the ability to conduct online virtual appointments is critical. Learn more at texasoncology.com.
You got to tune to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Now, at the top of our broadcast, we mentioned the staggering unemployment numbers, almost certain to fuel a push for a return to business as usual. In fact, tomorrow, Governor Greg Abbott is expected to release details for a plan to reopen the Texas economy. But a Texas A&M expert is warning against moving too quickly. Indeed, he suggests we're not even halfway out of the woods when it comes to safety. Dr. Gerald Parker is director of the Pandemic and Biosecurity Policy Program at the Bush School of Government and Public Service, Texas A&M College Station. Dr. Parker, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you.
It's been reported that you have identified five stages of a pandemic. I suppose we should begin by asking you, what are those five stages?
Well, yes, thank you. I propose five stages. We've already gone through phase one, which is containment. We are clearly in phase two, which is the mitigation phase, which is we're all living through with a broad community-based social distancing, social separation interventions in place. We need to move to phase three, though. And phase three is what I call, again, a containment phase, but before we have a vaccine. And then the phase four would be containment, but after a vaccine. And then finally, one of the most important things is preparedness. In the future, we've got to prepare for emerging infectious diseases and pandemics, like the Defense Department prepares for a war, and we hopefully never have to fight.
Thinking about a way forward, as many people are right now, are there certain markers that epidemiologists would be looking for if they're trying to determine, like, say, where we're at right now? You put us in that second stage, right? So how do you know when you're moving to that third stage, when you're still, you know, the hunt's still on for a vaccine?
Well, yeah, the hunt is still on. We're still clearly in phase two, but we're seeing hopeful signs that we're getting close to being, you know, the plateau of the epi peak that everybody, I think, is familiar with now. And there's some places in the United States where we're seeing decreasing new cases, suggesting we're on the downslope in some places. Texas is actually looks much better than other states as far as the number of cases that we've had. But we need to be clearly on the other side of that slope, on the downslide, in a position that our public health authorities can get back to containment, which would be diagnose, isolate, do contact tracing, and treat new cases that will occur.
Doctor, I want to ask about what you're mentioning when you said Texas seems to be done better than many other places. Some would say, well, that maybe that's because we haven't had as much testing here as they have, say, in New York State, for example. And there hasn't been enough testing to go to that next level of lifting stay-at-home orders. What would you say to that?
Well, testing certainly has been a problem across the United States. And Texas has been dependent upon getting the reagents and diagnostic kits and so forth that have been turned out at the federal level and turned on from the private sector, so forth. But we can also look at, you know, hospitalized, you know, people who are seeking medical care, those who are really, you know, sick, seeking medical care. That's a good indication of, you know, irrespective of the number of tests that we've been able to run in Texas. And we have run a lot more in Texas relative to a month ago, but it's still not where it needs to be.
What does the end of this pandemic potentially look like? How do you see it, and how far off do you think it is?
Well, we are in it for the long haul, but we can get on the other side of this curve and get it in a place where we can manage this and begin to phase reopen segments of our economy. But there will be a new normal. I can't predict what that new normal will be, but I think we'll all be much more conscious about personal infection disease hygiene. I think we're going to see innovations. In fact, I am really confident in the spirit of innovation in our small businesses in Texas, particularly. And they're going to come up with safe ways that some of their businesses can reopen and serve their stakeholders and customers in new and fundamentally new ways that'll be safe.
We don't have much time, but just briefly, if you were advising the governor in something like this, would you say, okay, let's not even think about a return to normal, to lifting these orders until what, June or July, or until we get a signal that there's a vaccine on the horizon? What would you tell him?
Well, we cannot stay in lockdown forever. That's just the economic consequences will also have medical public health implications. Texas is a big state, and we have a diversity of communities in Texas, from very high population dense areas to very rural areas. And so one size does not fit all in Texas. And so we need to give local authorities some flexibility and adaptability in how they also manage their communities and begin to reopen the economies across Texas.
Dr. Gerald Parker is director of the Pandemic and Biosecurity Policy Program, Bush School of Government, Public Service, Texas A&M. Dr. Parker, thank you so much for spending a few minutes with us.
Thank you.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Joining us once again, it's our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. Seeing this interesting story from the New York Times, Small Business Administration has run out of money for its $349 billion lending program. Of course, we've been talking about the news not being good on this jobless claims situation. 1 million Texans have filed unemployment claims, the state reports now, and we're looking at 22 million over the past month.
Yeah. Simply staggering numbers. Yeah, just completely eclipsing any sort of previous record. Arguably a sign of success with all that small business paycheck protection loan money going so quickly. Big question right now is whether or not they'll find Congress will authorize more funds for that. I know a lot of small businesses had trouble accessing that money. Heard earlier about this story in the news roundup. It also has folks talking. This Texas judge that said Wednesday that voters concerned about contracting COVID-19 could use mail-in ballots during upcoming elections, the runoff in July, and yes, the November presidential election. And, you know, we've been talking about this a bunch. This has been a topic of enormous interest everywhere from the federal to the state and local levels. And this latest ruling from a Travis County District Court judge was certain to keep that conversation going. The state's expected to appeal the ruling. Here's what we're seeing in terms of reaction on social media. On our Facebook page, Linda Hallett says instead of appealing the ruling, the state should use that money to start to prepare for it. At least 7 states can vote by mail. It's time that Texas joins that list and takes all appropriate measures to make it work. Meanwhile, Nicole LeBlanc, she predicts that Texas conservative leaders will continue to fight this tooth and nail. And I'm not holding my breath for the Supreme Court to be apolitical on this, she writes, should one or more states' lawsuits make it that far. And lastly, Dana Rowan, she writes that statistically forcing people to stand in line for up to 6 hours in Houston last go around during a dangerous pandemic could cost lives, maybe not the lives of those in line, but potentially someone who is more vulnerable to the virus. So obviously, issue that really I don't think it's going too far out on a limb to say has life and death stakes attached to it that people are continuing to follow very closely.
Well, it was interesting. I don't know whether you saw that aspect of Ken Paxton's message where he said people who advocate doing vote by mail could be in trouble too because they would be advocating breaking the law. And it was quite a thing. A lot of conversation, I'm sure, on social media right now.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So watch that space for more. And of course, continuing to hear about that huge spike in the unemployment numbers out there, sort of echoing what we just heard about this broader debate over how to best get the economy going again. On our Facebook page, Val Bankston notes that no economy would survive in a stay-at-home environment. This deficit we're seeing is a product of both sides. Government as a whole has failed in their responsibilities, he writes. Obviously, a lot of anger out there along with uncertainty over our new economic situation, David.
We're out of time for the big broadcast, but the news continues over at TexasStandard.org. We hope you'll join us on the radio side once again tomorrow. Till then, I'm David Brown wishing you a terrific Thursday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and the Cynthia and George Mitchell Foundation.